Good to have Kevin Binkley able to come to the front and lead prayer. For those of you who don't know, probably all do, Kevin's had both knees replaced in the last few months, and that's certainly a testimony to modern science and what healthcare can do today. He sent me a joke the other day. This guy was called for jury duty. He got up there, and the lawyer was asking the questions to see if he was going to be on the jury or not. The lawyer said, "What do you do for a living?" He said, "I'm a high school teacher." He says, "What do you teach?" He says, "Well, I teach English and theater." And the lawyer said, "Well, I better be careful or you'll correct my grammar." And the guy says, "No, you need to be careful. I'll correct your acting." He was dismissed from jury duty. So if you ever get an opportunity, that's a valuable approach, perhaps. This morning, we're going to start with looking at a centurion. We welcome all of you here today. The centurion was the backbone of the Roman army. Rome was extremely powerful, and there are many, many reasons why it was. But you can't get past the fact that they had this incredible military machine. And for all the strategy and for all the leadership and for all of the different things that you can point to, the equipment, this guy on the front line that had gotten there through experience and bravery and dedication, that sort of thing, really was the answer to why this army was so successful. They weren't there because of their education. They weren't there necessarily because of their skill. They were there because of the way they had performed in battle. And when they had performed at a certain level, they were put in charge of a group. And that group was to follow them, not by what they said, but by the example that they set. And they were tremendously forceful in that process. Rome's soldiers were paid very, very little money. But centurions were paid a lot of money. And so there was a significant step up financially when you became a centurion. And there are also centurions over centurions. And those people, as they went up the ladder, made increasingly larger sums of money. Sometimes, as we're going to do today, we're going to read about a rich centurion. And people go, "I don't really get it. I didn't think that Roman army people were paid all that much." Well, the average soldier wasn't, but these centurions really were. That obviously refers to 100 people, and originally they were the commanders of 100 men, but by Jesus' time, they are in administrative posts, they're in leadership positions, some of them. Some of them have smaller groups, maybe as few as 8 or 10 people, and other groups would have been several hundred. So the idea of just 100 is no longer exactly there. Today we're going to return to the book of Luke. As you know, we started that the first of the year, and I took out the last 6 weeks to do sermon requests, and I thank you very much for those requests. I had a lot of good comments and created a lot of good discussions, and we'll go back to that from time to time. But this morning we're going to go back to Luke chapter 7. The place where we left Jesus was the Sermon on the Plain, which is a parallel to the Sermon on the Mount, although it doesn't cover all of that information. And in Luke chapter 7, Jesus is going to have an encounter with a centurion. We'll start in verse 1 and go down through verse 10. When Jesus had finished saying all this to the people who were listening, he entered Capernaum. He just finished this Sermon on the Plain. There, a centurion servant, whom his master valued highly, was sick and about to die. And this is the first indication that we get this centurion is unusual. He cares about a servant. Now, probably typically, it was somebody that he owned. Centurions are certainly not known for being the touchy-feely kind of guys that somebody might have in another situation. And so this isn't typical. And so we're seeing an atypical person being presented to us here. He has a heart. The centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and heal his servant. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him. "This man deserves to have you do this. Two reasons, listed in verse 5, because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue." He's a leading member of an oppressive army. Just think about that for just a minute. And if we were to create a parallel for us today, what if some other nation, Russia, Iran, somebody like that, had come and actually taken over and occupied the United States? Well, the animosity would be incredible. And certainly among the Jews and the way they feel about the Romans, that animosity is certainly there. But in this situation, this man who works for this oppressive army loves their country, and he's built them a synagogue. Let me show you a couple pictures here. This is called the White Synagogue. This is the synagogue, the ruins of the synagogue at Capernaum from Jesus' era. This is the building that this particular centurion would have either built or helped to build. And you can go there to this day and see these ruins. He was willing to share, willing to contribute. We don't know if he was a Jew, a proselyte Jew, or maybe in the process of becoming a proselyte Jew. But for whatever reasons, maybe it was just goodwill in the community. Nobody knows for sure. But he, out of his own personal funds, had built a synagogue for the people in that area. Verse 6. So Jesus went with them. He was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends to say to him, "Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof." Wasn't the centurion's intent that Jesus would actually come into his house. He just wanted Jesus to come there. Verse 11, That is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. But, and look at this next phrase, say the word and my servant will be healed. All you have to do is say the word. What did God do in the creation of the world? Let there be. All he has to do is say the word and those things happen. And then the centurion is going to give just a little more explanation. For I myself am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes. And I say to that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. What's he saying? Well, I understand power. I understand authority. I understand how it works. And I understand that you don't have to come to my house and put your hands on my servant. I understand that you don't even have to be present. I understand that you have the kind of power that goes all the way back to the beginning, the creation of the world. You are God, is literally what he's saying. And Jesus responds to this very emphatically. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him. Now, a lot of times people are going to hear Jesus and they're going to be amazed, but it isn't often that Jesus is amazed at the response. Turning to the crowd following him, he said, "I tell you, I have not found such great faith even in Israel." This foreigner, this member of an oppressive army, has demonstrated more faith than Jesus has found in any of the people that he came to reach and came to minister to. And he's pointing that out for all of those folks. And then so we'll understand. Verse 10 is there. Then the men who had been sent returned to the house and found the servant well. Where would you have expected Jesus to find faith? If you didn't know the Bible story, if you didn't know the story of the Gospels, if you didn't know Jesus' interaction with the people that were part of his world, and somebody said to you, where would you go? Where would Jesus, the Son of God, go to find the people of faith? Well, I think that'd be pretty obvious. You'd say, well, he'll go to the religious leaders. He'll go to the religious institutions. There he'll find the people who've invested their whole lives in the relationship and service to God. There he'll find the people of faith. But he didn't. Those people were the least likely to respond to what Jesus was doing. Those were the people who resisted him the most, and those are ultimately the people who decided that he needed to die, and they actually accomplished that. Where did Jesus actually find faith? In a group of fishermen, a tax collector who was hated by everybody, There's a guy in his group that they refer to as the zealot. Some people will translate that to mean hothead, patriot, Canaanite, any number of different descriptions. And you go on from there. He found faith in a group of women of resources. And in the very next chapter that we're going to look at in Luke chapter 8, you'll see a description, and we'll talk about some of those individual people who actually physically supported the ministry of Jesus out of their own pockets. He found faith in the people that he helped, the people who received miraculous interventions, and certainly that makes sense. He found faith in the crowds, the people who responded to the triumphal entry, the people that the Jews were afraid of and knew that they had to get Jesus away from those folks in order to take him prisoner and to do what they wanted to do with him. He found faith in the ordinary people who were living life. What about our time? Don't you think we'd be tempted to look at it the same way? If you're going to find people of faith, and you're going to find the people who are known for religion, you're going to find people, you're going to find the people who've written all the books, the people who have all the education, the people who are associated with or tied to religious institutions, those are going to be the faithful. Now, I'm not this morning saying that's impossible. I'm not saying that doesn't ever happen. But what I am saying is that sometimes we lose the sight of the fact that the average ordinary person is this incredible example of faith. And it's easy for us to sit back and say, well, you know, I'm not an author, I'm not a teacher, I'm not educated, I'm not in this particular area, I'm not associated with an institution of higher learning, therefore what I do may not be as important as what these people are doing. And in Jesus' case, who are the people that spread the gospel throughout the world? They're these people that he's trained, these average, ordinary folks. In Amos chapter 5, verse 21, I find a passage that is extremely frightening. God says, I despise your religious festivals. Your assemblies are a stench to me. He looked at the status quo. He looked at the status leadership groups and he said, literally, you make me ill. And we don't want to hear that. That's not where we want to be. That's not the position that we want for God to have us, the perspective that God has for us. We don't want to be those people who are just going through the motions. You know, they're clicking off the list. They're punching the clock. They're doing all the good things, but their heart's not in it. They're not doing it because they have faith. They're doing it because it's what they're supposed to do. Luke chapter 18, verse 8. I tell you, he will see that they get justice and quickly. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? Will he find faith among us? Will he find faith in my house? Will he find faith in my heart? I think there are three different groups that really kind of embody the way that we come to have faith. The first group is those who are blessed to have people in their lives who teach them about faith, who model faith, who give them their faith. And that individual who's taught and led in that way understands that, and he sees how that works, or she how that works. And so he says, that's what I want to do, and that's how I want to live my life. And so they have that faith as their own. And some of you here today are from that category. And that's a wonderful thing. It's an incredible blessing that we have. There are others who find their faith in the hardest of circumstances. They find faith in the difficult disasters of life. Those moments where they recognize that it's not within them to answer the question or to provide the resource. And so they look to something bigger than themselves. The third group is really, I think, the majority of us. So many are raised as group number one,
and then they leave the faith, and then they rediscover their faith, often because of difficult circumstances. Those things that happen that cause us to re-examine where we are and to recognize what we really were taught and given at an earlier place. You can find faith in a cemetery, in a children's ward at the hospital. You can find faith in a divorce court or a bankruptcy court. You can find faith in the unemployment line. You can find faith at the therapist or behind bars. You can find faith when doubt and pain and hopeless circumstances and unfair attacks seem to be everywhere in your life. And those moments when we're so hard pressed by that, we look up and we recognize, much like the prodigal son, I know better than this. I've been taught. I've been given. I've had the keys of life revealed to me. And so I'm going to go back and I'm going to be a person of faith. There are people in this room today who've experienced that. And I believe to some degree all of us experience that, at least on some level. You may be familiar with the C.S. Lewis book, The Pilgrim's Regress. This was C.S. Lewis's first book after rediscovering his faith. This a parallel form to The Pilgrim's Progress, written by John Bunyan. But the whole theme of this book is that our lives progress by retracing our steps. Go back to where you were. Go back to what you experienced earlier. Go back to what you learned and were taught at an earlier point in time in your life. You know, you lose your car keys. What do people tell you? Well, retrace your steps. What have you done since then? Go back through the process. And sometimes when you do that, you actually find them. That's the parallel that Lewis is giving us. It's not about always moving forward. We live in a world that says, go forward, go ahead, attack, all of those things. And sometimes spiritually, it's about, well, you know, I've already missed it. I need to retrace where I was in order to find out where I need to be. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6. We know this. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to Him must believe that He exists, and He rewards those who earnestly seek Him. There are challenges to our faith daily, and we all know from our own faith experience that faith ebbs and flows. There are times when we're really influenced by doubt, and we have to work through that doubt. There are times when things look really bleak, and we really have to readjust and recharge our faith in order to handle those times. We also know that at those periods of weakness, that Satan can overwhelm us, and he can take us over totally and completely. And we use those times, hopefully, to rebuild our faith. I've mentioned a good friend of mine many, many times, and I probably will many, many more. He's a recovering alcoholic, and he believes with all his heart that life comes down to only two things: fear and faith. Everything you worry about, everything that's a concern to you, everything that complicates your life can ultimately be traced back to fear. And you know, you can play that game, and it's an interesting game to play in a discussion situation. You know, what are you afraid? Well, you know, what's really hanging over your head today? Well, I'm afraid that I won't have money for my mortgage payment. Well, what's the real cause of that? Well, the real cause of that is you're afraid you're going to lose your house. You're afraid you're not going to be able to take care of your family. So many in our relationships, we're afraid for that person, or we're afraid for ourselves. When you just really look at the things that have a tendency to eat us up, it's because we're afraid. All of our problems are rooted in fear. And all of the answers are rooted in faith. Is there enough faith to drive out the fear? Or as it says on the screen right now, can we let our faith be bigger than our fears? And that's really the simplest thing that it's boiled down to. I'm afraid. Satan manipulates that and makes me even more afraid. And my Savior says to me, don't be afraid. You don't have to be afraid. I've given you the resources to overcome this fear. And you can do that. We see in this story of Jesus' life somebody that you didn't expect to be among the faithful, and yet he is. Even with what he was dealing with, and even against the odds, he stands out as this supreme example of faith. And he makes us aware of the fact that we can do that as well. Ephesians chapter 2, I'll end with this. For it is by grace you have been saved through faith. And this is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God. God's grace has been given to us so that we can be saved. We experience and we practice our faith. And that leads us to God, and it leads us to being the people that he wants us to be. This morning, if your relationship to God needs to be altered in any shape, form, or fashion, if we can help you in that process, we'd be glad to do that while we stand and sing this song together.